From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Throughout her career, poet Anne Sexton was a controversial figure. She became popular after turning to poetry in the late 50s at the suggestion of her therapist, but she continued to suffer from mental illness and eventually killed herself. Now Sexton's biography has become controversial because her biographer, Diane Middlebrook, drew from recordings of Sexton's psychiatric sessions. On this edition of Fresh Air, Diane Middlebrook on the moral dilemmas she faced writing this biography. Also, Carol Ione on her new memoir, Pride of Family, Four Generations of American Women of Color. And rock historian Ed Ward remembers the era of show bands when white bands toured the South playing soul music for white audiences. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. As the authority of the Central Soviet government continues to wane, the Russian Republic has been establishing new relationships with its neighbors. Today, Russia signed an agreement with Kazakhstan saying that both sides would respect their common border and promising to negotiate new economic links. Yesterday, Russia signed a similar pact with the Ukraine. NPR's Tom Gelton is in Kiev, the capital of the Ukraine, and he says people there see a new order emerging.
Ukrainians say there's no question about it. The Soviet Union that we used to know is now dead and will not come back. And that seems to be the same judgment that leaders of other republics are making. But in its wake, you're not going to just have 15 self-standing independent republics. They are already beginning to move back together again in some new, looser form, with close economic ties, close military ties, and even perhaps a single defense and foreign policy. The analogy, the model that is heard most often here in Kiev and Ukraine is something like the European community. The future Soviet Union will resemble an association of that kind.
NPR's Tom Gelton. The United States has protested an Iraqi incursion on a strategic island belonging to Kuwait. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said that the border incident was part of a pattern of violations of the Gulf War ceasefire. Iraq has denied the incursion, but Kuwait says that it captured 59 Iraqis who landed on Boubian Island in an attempt to scavenge ammunition left behind during the Gulf War. Kuwaiti authorities say that their Coast Guard and Air Force destroyed 7 Iraqi naval vessels in the fight over the island. The Yugoslav central government has given its support to a new European Community peace plan that puts pressure on the Republic of Serbia to stop the fighting between Croats and ethnic Serbs. Despite the plan, fierce fighting continues in the Republic of Croatia. Jim Fish filed this report for the BBC.
The European plan calls for the consent of all parties by this Sunday, September the 1st. Thereafter, Serbia risks not only diplomatic but also economic isolation, according to the warning of economic sanctions issued by the Dutch Foreign Minister, Mr. Hans van den Broek. After a short lull, more fighting has been reported in the Banja region south of the Croatian capital, Zagreb. According to Radio Belgrade, clashes were taking place around the contested town of Kostajnica, although no details of casualties have been given. Meanwhile, more than 1,000 women kept up the second day of their protest sit-in at an army base in Belgrade, demanding the release of their sons from military service.
Jim Fish in Belgrade. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 6 points today to close at 3,043.6. This is NPR News. The Associated Press reported today that government prosecutors have paid more than $1.5 million to informants against former Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega. Noriega is set to stand trial next month on federal drug and racketeering charges. The report cited government documents showing that the payments were made to 6 men, including several drug dealers. The AP quoted sources as saying that the documents show that more than $500,000 has been paid to a Panamanian pilot who was caught in Florida with a plane load of cocaine in 1987. France's justice minister said today that he's opening an investigation into allegations that Noriega helped finance the 1988 election campaign of President François Mitterrand. Lynn Terry reports.
Justice Minister Alphine Allais, who was President Mitterrand's treasurer during the campaign, said the inquiry would try to establish the authenticity of a letter which the allegations are based on. This letter was written on the stationery of the French embassy in Panama and was cited earlier this week by the respected Paris-based Daily Le Monde. The newspaper said the socialists had worked out a deal to receive 3% of contracts signed between a French company and the Panamanian government. It's well known here that political parties have often been financed by kickbacks in the past. Both the Socialist Party and the Panamanian government have denied the allegations. Justice Minister Nalet says the letter could be a fake, since it's dated May 18, 1987, 2 years after the French official who signed it had left the Foreign Service. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Senator Edward Kennedy testified today before a grand jury that's considering obstruction of justice charges against a longtime friend of the Kennedy family. The target of the obstruction probe has been identified as William Berry, a New York security consultant who was at the Kennedy home in Palm Beach on the night that William Kennedy Smith is accused of raping a woman there. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You've probably already heard about one of the controversies surrounding a new biography of the poet Anne Sexton. This biography uses as source material tape recordings of therapy sessions Sexton had with her psychiatrist. My guest is the author of the biography, Diane Middlebrook. She's a professor of English at Stanford University. There are many thorny issues Middlebrook had to deal with. Anne Sexton was tortured by a mental disorder and started writing poetry as a suicidal housewife undergoing psychiatric treatment. Some of her poetry was about being institutionalized, some about her self-destructive impulses. Sexton succeeded in taking her life in 1974 at the age of 45. Some people think the romance of self-destruction won her a larger following than her poems deserved. Others say she was never taken as seriously as she should have been by the male literary establishment because her poems are often about subjects like women's sexuality and menstruation. In 1980, Diane Middlebrook was asked by Sexton's daughter, Linda, to write her mother's biography. Middlebrook was surprised by the invitation, but agreed to do it.
I did, though, have a certain question about whether I was the right person because I was not a big fan of Anne Sexton's poetry. I had my preferences. I thought they were gems, but I didn't, I wasn't just a passionate fan of her work. And I told Linda Sexton that right away. She said to me, well, I'm not much of a fan of academic writing either, but I know we need a scholar to do this book. So why don't you write a prospectus and let's go from there? So it was a decision taken on both sides with the sense that there was a goal to be met, which was a book that had a reliable research behind it and that was going to be based on extremely extensive records of a most private and confidential kind. From the outset, Linda Sexton had decided, that no biographer I think has had the luck I had in this regard, that every document that Anne Sexton left behind was going to be open to the biographer for at least deep background reading. Whether I could use it or not would be a decision made later, and I agreed with Linda at the outset in a businesslike way that at the end of the process of writing it, I would show her the book, and of course it was hers to withdraw permission or withhold permission to quote unpublished material, which included, of course, any of the comments that she made on her therapy tapes or in her therapy notebooks, but that basically I could use my own, it was my book.
Now, the tapes is a whole different subject, and I want to get to that in a couple of minutes. First, I want to know this. Since you weren't Anne Sexton's biggest fan, what made you think that she was really important enough to devote a biography to and to devote your time to?
She had an extremely important career. I knew that at the outset. That is, I knew the Sexton myth that I knew was a woman who rose out of a mental breakdown to become a poet almost overnight, became a very popular poet. About 500,000 books have been sold. That's a lot for a poet. And who had a very big audience and a very successful business career in poetry at a time in American poetry when the women's movement was just getting generated, really, out of circumstances like Sexton's. The housewife who has the breakdown, who finds herself and becomes a professional, who has a very sort of exhibitionistic sexuality, who performs very, very well, and who kills herself. All of those were sort of part of the, in a sense, the pre-1975 women's movement material. That interested me a lot. I also knew that I had a lot of biases that were built into my own education, which was not heavy on women's literature, I must say, and also that there was in me a kind of a creepy fear of people like Anne Sexton, people I just kind of wanted to keep out of my consciousness, and all of those seemed like good reasons to be interested in her.
I'd like you to read a poem by Anne Sexton that you think is an example of her writing at her best.
Sexton was a master of technique. And she remained that throughout her life. When she learned to write, she went to school, basically, to very formalist writers. It was a skill that she never lost. She didn't use it very much in her later work. However, there's a series of poems in her book, her most popular book, Love Poems, that I think is just lovely and very gripping. And to people who don't know Anne Sexton's work very well, it seems to me this one will give a feeling of both of the mastery of technique and the utter intimacy of her voice. This is one of the sequence, 18 Days Without You, and this is December 11th. Then I think of you in bed, your tongue half chocolate, half ocean, of the houses that you swing into, of the steel wool hair on your head, of your persistent hands, and then how we gnaw at the barrier because we are two. How you come and take my blood cup and link me together and take my brine. We are bare. We are stripped to the bone, and we swim in tandem and go up and up the river, the identical river called mine, and we enter together. No one's alone. Now, that poem, as I think you could probably hear, is very tightly rhymed. Cup and up. Brine rhymes in a way with bone and alone. It also rhymes with mine. There are all these beautiful little interior chimes in the poem, and yet it has, I think, the expressive urgency of something that's occurring as the lines fall. It's an emotion, a curve of affect being traced by the poem. That is Sexton at her best. She is an intimate writer, and the sense of a deep feeling, the reality of feeling, is very present in her work when she is writing, I think, at top speed.
Mm-hmm. Hey, listen, if you're just joining us, my guest is Diane Middlebrook, who's just written a biography of the poet Anne Sexton. Now, in your introduction to the biography, you say that there were several questions you were particularly interested in trying to answer. How did a mad housewife become a star? What connected her madness and her art? And I want to ask you, what are some of the special problems when you're a biographer of writing about an artist who was mad?
I think the illness tends to take such prominence, first of all, because an illness like Sexton's is very repetitious. You know, it happened, so it has to be said, but it gets boring as reading it. It suddenly becomes the thing you're fearing as a reader, so bracing yourself again, is she going to commit suicide again? And I knew that was a writing problem in a way. The illness is the ground from which the arc of achievement has to be launched. So trying to subdue the madness, trying to account for it, to get it compartmentalized or, let's say, understood, focused on, and then passed beyond became for me the goal because I did not want to write a victim story in this book. Equally, I was concerned about ending the book with suicide because the rules of narrative say that the way a book ends tells you what it's been about. And so I didn't want it to be read as a book that is leading inexorably to self-destruction. And I didn't see how I could solve that problem, actually, for a long time. I wrote her suicide in the middle of the book as one of the, you know, it's like I sort of stepped back and said, okay, here's another suicide attempt. Now, eventually, she killed herself, but it was part of her repetitious illness, da-da-da. Turned out that that was far too abstract and academic a way to treat it. I needed to put it at the end of the book, but I didn't want it to... I didn't understand it well enough when I was still afraid of it to not to understand that Anne Sexton had, in fact, killed herself in a very dignified and, in my view, timely way. When the material finally unfolded and showed itself to me in its full, I think, ceremonial beauty, I felt much better about permitting the book to end where it had to end.
Now, your biography of Anne Sexton has become very controversial because you used tapes from her psychiatric sessions, tapes that her psychiatrist had kept, and Anne Sexton's daughter, who is responsible for the literary estate, decided to let you have those tapes. Now, some people think you really should not have used them, but you did, and we'll get to why in a minute. But you know, you say that after hearing the tapes, you started the book over from scratch. What did you hear that made you think you had to redefine in your whole approach to writing this biography?
I think that I had treated Sexton in my first manuscript as a kind of a historical figure. who was kept at a distance in a way. I thought that there were a lot of interesting things about her. I'd written a chapter called Suicide. I'd written a chapter called Therapies. I'd written a chapter, actually, on the school that Anne Sexton went to, which was poetry workshops. It seemed to me she was a product of a very interesting American sort of education. So I took a sort of historical interest in her. And also, I found later, I think I had a lot of defenses against Anne Sexton. I didn't want to get too close to her. So the manuscript I wrote, I think it was really pretty good, but it was also very abstract. It was also more like a series of lectures than it was a narrative. When I came close to her, as I did, by having her pass through my head in earphones for a couple of years, she became a real person to me. And I also, I found myself very attached to her. I was curious about things that she said and felt. I was very amused by her. She's very funny. She had a great voice. She was a wonderful actress. Even in these tapes, you can feel the range of character she was able to project. And she also was much sicker than I ever realized she was. So I had an intimate kind of relationship to her at the end of that process that made me feel that I needed to write a story about her, actually. And I think all the thinking I had done in advance served me very well. It sort of got submerged in the narrative, but what took over was the story of a life. And I think the book is much better for that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Diane Middlebrook, who's just completed her biography of Anne Sexton. And we're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about this biography. This is Fresh Air. Diane Middlebrook is my guest, the author of a new biography of the late poet Anne Sexton. Sessions between doctor and therapist are always confidential, and a lot of people feel that these tapes should not have been source material for your biography, that they should have remained confidential between the patient and the doctor. And even the chair of the Ethics Committee of the American Psychiatric Association said, "Our viewpoint is that only the patient can give the release. What the family wants doesn't matter." And he made it clear that he thought that the confidentiality between patient and therapist should extend beyond the life of the patient. Tell me why you decided that, in spite of that confidential relationship, that these tapes should be source material.
Well, I'm a biographer, not a psychiatrist. And first of all, the question of the release of material to the family is not a hard and fast rule in psychiatry. After all, I was through the estate, I was able to have access to psychiatric hospital records, which are full of clinical notes. And those are routinely released. Sometimes it takes a court order, other times just a family request. But there is that psychiatric records are passed from hospitals anyway to families. The question of the doctor-patient dyad and its the ability to, let's say, invade it as I've done, it really does rest on the patient's willingness, on some views take another one, but in any case, the internal debate about the ethics of confidentiality within the psychiatry profession is itself, I think, more ambiguous and complicated than that statement from a very authoritative source would suggest. But a biographer looks at a person, I think, as, in a funny way, a sort of a generator of documents and memories that the biographer has a special privilege toward. I wouldn't dream of reading, or would dream of it, but I wouldn't do it, reading my husband's mail, for example, when he's alive. Those things are his stuff. But once you die, you're beyond harm. And if you're a person in whom society takes an interest, those things you leave behind become really cultural property, I think is the word I'd want to use. And Sexton did have, I think, an attitude, as one of her friends said to me, psychotherapy was not an intimate subject to her. She was in it all the time. She took it very casually. She leaked it to friends. She played her tapes to people. She transcribed them and sent them to people. So she herself didn't feel the confidentiality issue was not a big deal to her. Now, she did not sign a statement about that, so that's why it's disputed.
What about her family. Now, her daughter, Linda, wanted things to be as complete and revealing as possible. But, for instance, there was recently a letter in the New York Times Book Review by Sexton's nieces who were, you know, appalled by the biography. And I'm sure they didn't want those tapes to be source material. So how do you weigh wanting to make a dead artist's life public so we can better understand her and what she represents in our culture with wanting to protect the living, the family who survives, who still should have a right to privacy?
Well, of course, that is the central, I think, moral issue for somebody working in private papers. And my own guidelines were to try to avoid as far as possible exposing people to invasion. I was as selective as I could be in showing exemplary things about Sexton's life. And for example, at the end of the process of writing the book, I had worked very closely with Anne Sexton's living sister, who had given me a marvelous interview from which I drew heavily. She was a great storyteller, very generous. But as we got closer to the end, she had seen a couple of the versions of manuscripts of the biography. And at the end, she said, "I want you to take my interview out because I see that this is a book about Anne Sexton, and I don't want to be a party to the lies she told about my family." I said to her, "You know, growing up in a family, I find that I have a different parents from my sisters, you know, like what different things happen to us in family life. So the fact that you didn't have the relationships that Anne Sexton had to these people doesn't mean that she didn't have them. And it's, you know, clear that for her, these were very problematic relationships." Well, Blanche Taylor said to me, I think she said something that I thought was a very honorable position. She said, "I know, but my voice will only be one of a sort of a minor chorus here, and I would rather withdraw my support from the book. I want you to take out my stories. I want you to take out my quotations. I want you to take out the acknowledgement of me as a source, because I don't want to contribute to the prolongation of these myths." And I understood that, and I was very sorry to lose her in the book, but I did take her out.
You know, you didn't have to take her out legally, right? I mean, she'd given you the interview. She'd given you the information, and legally, I don't think she had the right to withdraw it. She was already on the record. Why did you let her take it back?
Because I thought she had a right to her own representation, actually. I know that that's true, that I don't think the legal and moral issues are the same at all. But what her complaint is that I didn't, in fact, buy her version of the family. That is the real point of debate in her letter. She's very angry, or her daughters who wrote the letter are angry that their version of the family story, which they provided me and, in fact, gave me in abundance, was not the one that I adopted. Instead, I adopted a very complicated set of attitudes and perspectives on the central issue of, was Anne Sexton actually sexually abused by her father? The book, I think, argues that, or observes that you can't know for certain, but that the evidence is that she was not, at least as I read the evidence, but that Sexton's own memory of this was what in psychoanalysis is called a screen memory, a way, a story or a scene narrated to account for a set of feelings that are so profound and troubling that they need to have an explanation associated with them. And her explanation was that she must have had sexual desire for her father, which when he was drunk, he exploited or observed or intuited, and then that was observed by her great aunt, who subsequently went mad. Now, Sexton was making an explanation for why her aunt went crazy. She thought it was her fault, and she thought it had to do with her sexuality. And that very complicated story, which is so layered and so significant and so eternally returned to in Sexton's work, is crystallized in this one memory or fantasy which she recovered in trance. Now, that is an extremely important whatever it is, and needed to be accounted for. And what I wanted to do was have the families register this could not have happened, because they are convinced that it didn't, but played off against the deeper movement of the unconscious toward desire, and that Sexton's own work, I think, indicates that for her, that story had a truth to it, which might have been a mythic truth, but which had powerful, compelling force in her own emotions. So that was what I was trying for. It was not what the family wanted, and that's why they decided to withdraw. And I think have also sort of set up camp outside the covers of the book to say, look, this is an abuse of us. This story should not have been told because it couldn't have been true. And I just don't think there is any way to resolve that.
Anne Sexton's daughter, Linda, after she read one of your manuscripts, came to you and said that there was something very important that she hadn't told you about yet that she thought should be included in the book, and that was the fact that her mother had sexually abused her, had lied next to her in bed and masturbated, that she once woke up and found her mother was on top of her and kissing her. What was your reaction to Linda telling you this, and did was it something that you questioned at all or that you knew right away you'd have to include in the book?
Well, I was appalled, but immediately I thought, of course, because Linda, in fact, recovered this memory in the course of reading my account of the development of Anne Sexton's play, Mercy Street, which is about an incestuous relationship between a father and a daughter and also the great aunt and the daughter. There's a very complicated sexual relationship that was very much something Sexton was exploring. And what Linda discovered and didn't tell me about immediately was that she remembered these episodes herself, and she could see in from reading the chronological account that they were happening when Anne was working on Mercy Street, that this would be, her father would be away, her mother would be involved in this deep engagement with this fantasy or memory of her own past, and she would begin to act it out with Linda. It was, I believe, a pathological kind of episode. I believe that she was probably dissociated or very much entranced when it happened. Still, it was an appalling, horrible discovery for me.
One of the questions you set out to answer is, why did Anne Sexton's poetry appeal to people who normally didn't like poetry? How much of that appeal do you think was her self-destruction, and what does that have to say?
I wish I knew. I'm sorry to say that the self-destructive impulses are things that people are drawn to look at, and Sexton knew that. She played on it. She gave an epigraph to one of her last books from Hemingway, "Look, you con man, make a living out of your death." It was a very cynical kind of epigraph. She knew that people loved the thrill of looking at somebody who had who'd been through self-destructive impulses, and she was able to act them out in her readings. Actually, she used to make this joke in the last year of her life that she was giving readings from her posthumous book. These very creepy sort of references to it was a given that she would kill herself. That was part of the Sexton persona that I did not like. I think, in fact, some people have made a connection with Madonna, and I think that's a good one. That is somebody who writes the material that she knows will be marketable and then stands there performing it and looking you in the eye and saying, are you getting off on this? You know, so Sexton was pretty complicated about that.
I regret I've left you about 60 seconds or less to answer this really complicated question, but when you're dealing with this really kind of complicated subject matter of somebody who is mad, who committed suicide, who might have been the victim of incest, who probably committed incest against her own daughter, everybody starts wondering, what's the difference here between a voyeuristic approach to somebody's life and a literary approach to somebody's life and where they fit into the culture? I know you've given this a lot of thought. Could you help us reason through it?
Yes, I didn't write a victim story. I found a person who was capable of turning her bad experiences or experiences of evil into something else, a transformation, which was the power of art. And though she couldn't save herself by art, she actually could call upon her most deep and painful experiences and turn them into something that was a sharing of the human condition. And I think that that helped her, that she saw that that was a good thing to have been able to do. That was the person I tried to write about.
Diane Wood Middlebrook. She's the author of Anne Sexton, A Biography. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Carol Ione was raised by three women, her mother, a writer, her grandmother, a former showgirl, and her great-aunt, a social reformer. It wasn't something she thought much about until she discovered the diary of her great-grandmother, Frances Ann Rollin, which is, by the way, now considered the first diary on record by a Southern black woman. Coming up, a talk with Carol Ione about her new memoir, Pride of Family, Four Generations of American Women of Color. And rock historian Ed Ward remembers the little-known era of show bands, when white bands toured the South playing soul music for white audiences. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Ukraine declared its independence from the Soviet Union last week, but today the Ukrainian president said his republic would take a step-by-step approach to independence. NPR's Tom Jelton reports from Kiev, the Ukrainian capital.
Already this week, the Ukrainian parliament, the Ukrainian Supreme Soviet, has voted to issue its own currency and to set up its own army. Both obvious steps that a country determined to be independent would take, and the Ukrainian parliament is wasting no time to take them. On the other hand, something a little different about the Ukraine, the Ukrainian president, Leonid Kravchuk, said today in a news conference that his republic is going to take a step-by-step, negotiated, gradual approach to independence. So even though it is issuing its own currency and setting up its own army, this will be a very slow process.
NPR's Tom Jelton in Kiev. Russia and Kazakhstan have signed an agreement to respect their existing common border. In terms of land mass, the two republics are the largest in the Soviet Union. The agreement calls for both republics to work against the uncontrolled disintegration of the USSR. The pact also calls upon all 15 Soviet republics to negotiate a new economic agreement. Yesterday, Russia signed a military and economic agreement with another key Soviet republic, the Ukraine. The Solidarity-led Polish government is coming under attack for the harsh austerity measures imposed on the country in an effort to shift to a market economy. Kathy Jenkins in Warsaw filed this report for the BBC.
The Polish Prime Minister, Jan Krzysztof Bielecki, submitted the resignation of his 8-month-old government after former communist MPs criticized proposed spending cuts. The government announced the large-scale cuts in an attempt to control Poland's recession, which has hit the country hard. This summer has seen hundreds of strikes, state enterprises going bankrupt, and growing inflation. Opponents of the Solidarity-led government said it had failed to work out adequate anti-recession measures, although the stringent economic policies have been praised by Western governments as the only way for Poland to transfer to a market economy. Leading Solidarity MPs have urged the government to stay and have asked the government's opponents to withdraw their call for a vote of no confidence. The Solidarity MPs argue that Poland cannot afford such political instability 2 months before the elections.
Kathy Jenkins in Warsaw. The Iranian news agency reported that Iraq has bombed scores of villages in southern Iraq over the past 10 days, killing hundreds of people near Basra. Quoting a report from the Tehran-based Supreme Assembly of the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, the agency said the army had used heavy artillery fire to shell villages. On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed today. The Dow lost 6 points to close at 3043.60. Advances edged declines in trading of 143 million shares. This is NPR News. The Magellan probe orbiting Venus has discovered a giant landslide on the planet, apparently triggered by an earthquake. Scientists at California's Jet Propulsion Laboratory say the discovery could mean Venus is still geologically active. Just yesterday, JPL announced that the probe had found the longest known channel in the solar system, longer than the Earth's Nile River. It measures about a mile across and more than 4,200 miles long. Venus is considered something of a twin to Earth. Both planets are similar in size and mass, but Venus is a planet with a greenhouse effect gone mad. A thick cloud cover traps solar radiation, keeping surface temperatures near 900 degrees Fahrenheit, hot enough to melt lead. Surface pressure is comparable to those found at an ocean depth of 2,500 to 3,000 feet on Earth. A standoff between Cuban detainees and government officials at the federal prison in Talladega, Alabama, ended early today when rescue teams stormed the unit where inmates were holding 9 hostages. Debbie Elliott of member station WUAL reports.
Warden Roger Scott says officials initiated the rescue effort after learning that inmates had threatened to kill hostages.
During the evening sick calls, the hostages sent out messages indicating they believe this might be their final opportunity to communicate with their loved ones. The situation in the unit was deteriorating.
Scott says detainees made hostages put their ID cards into a pillowcase and then drew out one card, telling that hostage he would be the first one killed. Scott says the hostages were safely rescued just minutes after rescue teams stormed the unit. Officers say the nine hostages are unharmed, but one inmate suffered a minor injury. Officials say deportations will resume immediately. For National Public Radio, I'm Debbie Elliott in Talladega, Alabama.
A federal bankruptcy judge has confirmed the reorganization of Greyhound Lines, but he left open the prospect of potentially large future payments to striking drivers. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. We sometimes see our own lives differently when we learn about the lives of our parents, their parents, and ancestors we never knew. And sometimes hearing about someone else's family history helps us understand our own. My guest Carol Ione has written a family memoir called Pride of Family, Four Generations of American Women of Color. Ione is a writer and psychotherapist. We invited her to talk with us about her family. This is the opening of her book.
The truth is, I knew I was female before I knew I was black. I was raised by three singular women, my mother, my grandmother, and my great aunt, and all my life I studied them, their smooth faces, the enigma of their bodies. Strong, proud, secretive, like the mythic beings in my storybooks, the women in my family presented themselves to me fully formed and without much history to speak of. They were simply there, with their hankies and hairpins, high heels and furs, perfumes and pianos, racing sheets and stethoscopes. My gambling grandmother was a high-kicking dancer in the great chorus lines of the 1920s and 30s, and she loved to play the numbers and bet the horses. My dignified great-aunt was a medical doctor and a social reformer. And my mother was a journalist and a writer of murder mysteries who also composed tropical songs. I hoped that one day I would be like these women, that they would accept me as one of them, that I would bask in their love and understanding and would share in all their secrets.
You know, hearing the descriptions of the women in your family, it sounds like such an extraordinary family. And you describe yourself and your mother and your grandmother as all having been rebel daughters. You all rebelled against each other.
Yes.
So really your story isn't one of the most close-knit family, of a family that's always just, you know, like celebrating the relationship. I mean, on the contrary, you were rebelling against each other. Over what? What did your mother rebel against? And then what, in turn, did you rebel against?
Well, it wasn't only rebelling against each other. It was rebelling against the world as well. Or shall we say, ordinary ways of doing things. We were each been quite headstrong. Wanting to lead our own lives. And my grandmother, for example, left her life as a young girl in the country of West Virginia in the mountains and ran away to become a dancer, leaving her mother, who had other ideas, leaving her mother behind. And my mother always wanted to live in Mexico and other countries and not to be in a small town like Saratoga Springs, which my grandmother, my gambling grandmother, loved. So she would go her own way, and she was a writer and wanted to be on her own. And I, too, did the same. I wanted to go off to Europe and live an expatriate life, to be an artist, to paint, to write, and not necessarily to lead the life that they seemed to want me to lead, which was a sort of settled down middle class life.
One of the things that precipitated the family memoir that you just wrote was finding the diary of your great grandmother.
Right.
And she's been described as America's first Southern black woman diarist. What does that mean?
Well, she was the first, she's, as far as we know, she is the earliest, her diary is the earliest diary that has been found at this point, written by a woman of color, and a woman from the South.
You've just written a family history, but you write that your mother hated everything reminiscent of family history.
Yes.
What kinds of things about family history did she reject?
Well, she grew up not wanting to hear about the past and looking toward the future, which is something I think that happens in many families. And she particularly didn't want to go back to the painful details of her own childhood because she was very lonely as a child. So I think that she always looked toward modern things, the concept of a modern life and nothing about the past.
And what made you interested in family history, given that you were brought up in a way having it rejected for you by your mother?
Well, I think that I always realized that there was something missing in my life, and I never knew exactly what it was. I had actually led a rather full life by many standards by the time that I was shown my great-grandmother's diary. And when I was shown it, when I did discover it, I realized, well, my goodness, this woman lived 100 and some years before me, and no one has ever really talked to me about her. So there indeed was something missing, and it was an enormous amount of history.
My guest is writer Carol Ione. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Carol Ione, author of the new memoir, Pride of Family, Four Generations of American Women of Color. This book ended up containing, for you, what you interpreted as advice and messages that really changed your life. What were some of the parallels you saw in your life and in the life of your great-grandmother?
Well, my great-grandmother was an abolitionist. She was a writer. You know, and at the time that I found the diary, I was trying to make a living as a freelance writer in New York and trying to raise three children at the same time, and I was struggling with all of that. And I immediately recognized the writer in my great-grandmother because her diary is a writer's diary and a record of how she was doing on a certain day and writing her book on Martin Delaney. She would write in the morning and she would read in the afternoon. In the evening, she'd go out to see people like Dickens and Emerson. And so she was very interested in literature, and so was I. And I this immediately struck my heart in a very, very strong way.
Why hadn't anyone told you about her?
Well, as I say, it's interesting. It's a hard question to answer succinctly because it took a book to answer it. But I would say that it was an accumulation of secrets, feeling of shame and loss that had gone through many generations of women in my family. And the loss was of different sorts and in different generations, but it went back to the French Revolution, shall we say, and it went back to the loss of country, of the islands, of people who came to Charleston, the loss of family and status, of my great-grandmother, who came from a free family of color in Charleston, which was one of my discoveries of a whole whole group of a layer of society, actually, living in Charleston of free people of color. There was a loss to them when the Civil War came, and that was quite an ironic loss since they were people of color. And after my great-grandmother was very much involved in the Reconstruction days, in which 80% of the first Reconstruction Congress in Charleston was black, and she was very, very much involved with that and married my great-grandfather, who was a legislator at that time. And their loss occurred when that revolution, because it was a revolution in which it was thought that black people and white people would be able to live together and govern together, that failed. And the Klan, the Ku Klux Klan, began to get more and more active. And this was a very, very harsh moment in my great-grandmother's life and in the life of black people in South Carolina and perhaps the country as a whole.
Did any of the women in your family talk with you about, you know, the expression being a credit to your race and a responsibility for you to be a leader?
Well, that was implied. It was never spoken in those terms, though. But the idea was not to do anything to discredit the race, and to be the best that one could be, to be smarter, to be careful. I think to be careful was the thing that was the hard thing about it. I was always trying to be correct, to not step on anybody's toes, and I think it was very limiting, actually.
Did you become less inhibited about that at a certain point in your life?
Yeah. Actually, as I grew older, I began to expand, and as I worked on this book, I was really able to come to an understanding of who I am that I really didn't have before, and a kind of wholeness of myself as a woman, as a human being, as a woman of color, that I didn't have before. And I feel that I came to that because I was really able to pull forward the ancestors, bring their stories forward, bring forward true feeling and true stories about all of them, so that they're really living and not dead.
Well, Carol Ione, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Carol Ione is the author of Pride of Family, Four Generations of American Women of Color. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel, host of All Things Considered. On today's program, news from the Soviet Union, we'll be hearing from correspondent Ann Garrels in Moscow. And NPR's Tom Jelton tells us what things are like in Kiev today. It's the capital of Ukraine, a republic that has declared independence, but signed a communique promising friendly relations with Russia in the coming years. And Jelton says the Ukrainians may be looking forward to remaining in some form of union, like the European Community, with Russia, even after their independence. Noah Adams commemorates the 100th anniversary of Glen Echo Amusement Park near Washington, D.C. today, and we'll have a look ahead with folklorist Nick Spitzer at the Johnstown, Pennsylvania Folk Fest, coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
It wasn't just Aretha Franklin or James Brown who introduced soul music to much of Middle America. Rock historian Ed Ward recalls that in the late 50s and 60s, white bands known as show bands toured the South and Midwest, playing blue-eyed soul music and whetting their audience's appetite for more.
Hey everybody, the Bamboo Hut, in conjunction with Montel Michelle Records, proudly presents The Band. That's thrilled audiences from Las Vegas to Miami. The Band, booked solid for 11 straight years. The Band has become a legend in the South. Ladies and gentlemen, from the beach at Galveston, Texas, this is the Blue-Eyed Soul Show with the Boogie King.
My friend Scoop used to have a t-shirt that showed a very nerdy-looking guy dancing with a beautiful girl. Behind the nerd, a guy who looked to be the size of the entire University of Texas front line was swinging a huge log about to connect with the nerd's head. The caption to the picture was, "Boppin' at the Big Oak, Vinton, Louisiana." Besides the obvious comedy, the shirt referred to an era of music that's long gone, one that was never really documented, a part of the 60s that was more than a little embarrassing, but still lives on in many people's hearts. It was the era of the show band, when such outfits as the Boogie Kings, the Soul Kings, the Triumphs, the Uniques, Wayne Cochran and the CC Riders, and John Fred and the Playboy Band ruled the beach nightclubs and fraternity houses of the South and Midwest. These bands were 8 to 12 guys in matching outfits, including several vocalists and a crack horn section. They toured incessantly, playing the latest hits, soul hits mostly, to audiences for whom show bands were nearly always the only live pop music they ever saw.
Feeling blue, with nothing to do, but to walk along the sideway, thinking of you. Into the streets, tears in my eyes. And much to my surprise, I heard a little boy sing,
"Rounding up the land is riding."
You know, I probably look real
fine.
Well, I said to him, yes.
The Boogie Kings, founded around Eunice, Louisiana in 1955, were one of the first, and they're still going. They never really had a hit record, mostly, I suppose, because they were too busy touring to record, and the records they did make are pretty awful. But they spawned lots of competition.
Right now, shining down on us, yeah. Right now, shining down on us, yeah. My baby and I, she thinks right. She knows she's out of sight, but there's one thing she don't like, and that's a bright night shining down on us, yeah. I said, bright night shining down on us, yeah.
The Triumphs got together in Houston in 1960 and worked East Texas with their patented light soul style, delivered by their tall, handsome singer, Billy Joe Thomas. When they finally got to record in 1966, Thomas insisted on being allowed to record one Hank Williams song along with the usual Triumphs material.
Did you hear that lonesome whippoorwill? He sounds too blue to fly. Is winding low, and I'm so lonesome I could cry.
The song was a smash, and B.J. Thomas's career was launched. Nor was Thomas the only country star to begin in a show band.
My love for that girl was a love have changed, they're not the same. Oh, she don't care for me, Lord. I said, the Boogie came along, and now she's gone.
The Uniques were contemporaries of the Triumphs, based in Louisiana, and their lead singer was a young man who'd been trying to make it since the late 50s without much success. The Uniques provided Joe Stampley with a decent living, and most importantly, an outlet for the songs he was writing. Finally, Stampley got a staff songwriting position with Al Gallico Music and moved to Nashville, where he became a big star in the 70s. The show band with the biggest hit was also the goofiest. John Fred Gourier, a former LSU basketball star, founded the Playboy Band in 1956, and they played extensively in northern Louisiana and Mississippi. Late in 1967, though, John Fred and the Playboy Band decided to make a psychedelic record, and to everyone's surprise, they wound up with a number one hit. Like the Boogie Kings, they're still playing. My friend Margaret saw John Fred a couple of weeks ago and says he looks all of 30 years old. Show bands ran up against their own contradictions. They played soul music for people who liked it, but didn't particularly like the people who originated it. As the walls of racism came down, black performers were no longer off limits to white audiences. Why go see a white guy try to do Wilson Pickett when you could go see Wilson Pickett do it after all? But bands like these also gave many fans their first glimpse of the blues and of soul music, impelling them to look further. If you'd like to go see a live show band in action, the Boogie Kings play a monthly gig at RT's Club and Pub in Baton Rouge.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, and he writes for the Austin Chronicle. Here's B.J. Thomas and the Triumphs with their version of a song you may remember.
I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour. That's when my love come tumbling down. I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour. Hey, hey, with no one else around. I'm gonna hold and love you and do all the things I told in the midnight hour. Yes, I am. Oh, yes, I am. One more thing I want to tell you right now.
If you have something to say about Fresh Air, don't just talk back to your radio. Call our listener line toll-free at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week, Richard Parker, Bob Alls, Thad Kirk, and Ojiva Blitus. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Groves.
Yeah, you do. Oh, yeah, you do.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with the great soul and gospel singer Al Green about his life before and after he was born again. And we hear from Studs Terkel, who thinks it's ironic he became celebrated for writing about the uncelebrated working men and women of America. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.